Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday, April 25th in the year 2014. This is Jeff Dunphy, and we are operating the retooling for our coming of age. I have returned from warm Phoenix to frosty Calgary. It is 4 degrees, a modest dive in temperature from 34 degrees to 4 degrees. However, back in the saddle and ready to further our service to those who are listening and those who have ears to hear and eyes to see. I had a very interesting occasion when I was down south, in that I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine, and after perhaps a few too many beverages, he responded with something that was, I found, a bit disconcerting, because it begs me to ask the question, am in fact I being of service by chatting about the things that are in the throes of happening? Now, that being said, I want to respond to his accusation or his declaration that, yes, I bitch and complain and moan and groan, but I don't give any viable answers or solutions. And we chatted a little about this, and the other individual who was with us this go-around very graciously noticed that my friend was quite distraught and quite upset at the fact that I wasn't offering solutions. And I'd like to respond to that, because I most definitely think, or maybe perhaps I was deluded in thinking that I am offering solutions, and now what I would like to do is perhaps bring those solutions a little more to the forefront. Now, in furthering our opening our eyes and turning the lights on, I want to chat a little about a variety of things, but then I also want to talk about what do solutions look like. However, this show, rather than reacquaint or remember the ancient teachings, I want to chat a little about what's going on globally, and certainly I want to focus on the stock market, which is a marketplace that I knew and know intimately and have had great lengthy experience in. Although, as some would say, I remember an individual was having a conversation with his dad, and his dad basically said, you know, I'm much older than you, had much more experience, to which this individual said, well, you may be 25 or 30 years my senior, Dad, but you've just lived the same 25 or 30 years all over again every single year. So there is lots to be said about living a life with your eyes wide open or living your life sound asleep. Now, I want to revisit a previous show, and I want to chat a little about the disillusion or the law of periodicity, and how it manifests itself in every civilization, in every cycle, in every mini-civilization, if you will, from the great ones, the Egyptians and the Romans and the Greeks, to the modest ones. I mean, the British Empire was not an inconsequential empire. The American Empire was not an inconsequential empire. And the new empire that is about to come about from us, about, is not only not going to be inconsequential, it is going to be quite profound. Forgive that, ladies and gentlemen. I was in the throes of coughing, and instead of pushing the mute button, I hung up on ourselves. Okay, now we're back to the task at hand, and we are back to the evolution of a civilization, the evolution of a period, the evolution of an empire, if you will. And I want to revisit what transpires as an empire unfolds and as an empire proceeds in its normal pattern. And we talk about how an open society plays itself out and how the society of various iterations. I mean, these 10 steps that close an open society were brought about by an individual who was evaluating the reign of the Nazis during the Third Reich. And In terms of that, it was a very short-lived one. It went from the early 30s to 1943, probably, when it started to implode. Certainly, the end of the war ended it. But you know, there are some big lessons. So I want to chat a little about democracy and how a democracy dissolves itself through greed. Okay, so a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. Or, as my friends pointed out at the dinner party, which is a very valid point, and it certainly is reiterating Churchill's perspective, is a democracy is a horrible form of government, but it's the best form of government we have at the moment. We certainly have seen that socialism or communism, if you will, that the jury is out in the fall of the Berlin Wall in the 80s was demonstrative of this. I will come and revisit that, but I definitely think that democracy and capitalism are progenitors of, if we have a society that is open-minded and carries the motto, as go we, so go I, this is in fact the way that things will unfold. However, a democracy, as I just said, can't exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. Vote for me, ladies and gentlemen, and I will give you a bunch of stuff. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy. Loose fiscal policy. This would be printing $85 billion a month of phony money, monopoly money, in order to facilitate the playing in the economy that happens to this. So after it collapses over loose fiscal policy, it's always followed by a dictatorship. And the average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. These nations have progressed through this sequence, from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to apathy, from apathy to dependence, and from dependence back into bondage. Now, this was written in 1775. Okay, color me curious. It's the beginning of the American empire, if you will. And it was about 200 years ago, give or take. So now, again, in my attempt to give us food for thought, and in my attempt to turn the lights on, I want to be mindful that I'm not creating an environment where the listeners are saying, yeah, that's all fine and good, but what can I do? And the first act of what you can do is being able to discriminate, being able to act in a discriminatory fashion. Listen to what you are hearing and do not bend over the context of belief and perhaps embrace the context of knowing. It's very important for you to know these things as opposed to believe them because somebody else is telling you to believe them. Because our objective is to turn on the lights so that you can see what is rather than what you're being told to believe. Back to the 10 steps that close an open society. So the first step, this was done again on Hitler's reign, but the first step to was invoke an internal and external threat. So the Germans did this with the Jews, and in fact it evolved into all of the non-Aryans, as Hitler defined them. And we've done it with fundamentalist terrorists. Step two is establish secret prisons for torture. Don't need to evaluate or elaborate on that too much, as we've already done that. Step three is to develop a paramilitary force. This Hitler did with SS, and this the United States did with the Department for Homeland Security. I might reiterate that the Department for Homeland Security has been warehousing, stockpiling bullets, deadly bullets, by the way, hollow point bullets. This would give us pause, because why would they, if they're protecting the homeland from external threats, I suggest that perhaps the stockpiling of bullets might have something to do with worrying about their position and power when the population wakes up to what they're doing. Now, am I suggesting anarchy? Am I suggesting revolting against the government? No, nothing of the sort. What I am suggesting is understand the government's agenda and act accordingly. Understand the system's constituency and understand that it may not necessarily be in your best interest to be in the system. Okay, step four is to surveil ordinary citizens. Well, hello, this is the whole Edward Snowden thing about how the U.S. is spying on absolutely everybody and how, you know, some of the pundits, certainly some of the information that is flowing out of this is, oh, no, we can't listen to everybody's telephone conversations. We can't listen to everybody's podcasts. And I call bullshit on that. I know because of my tenure as a technology professor that the technology that they have available today to surveil and to listen to phone conversations, I suspect would even blow everybody's mind if, in fact, we knew what was available. They can iterate. They can listen to every phone conversation. They can listen to phone conversations faster and more comprehensively than any of us would even begin to imagine. So step five is to infiltrate citizens' groups. We're starting to see this in the establishment of blogs that the CIA would put up and the creation of fronts where they can turn around and create their own intelligence gathering systems by appearing to be in the system. Step six is to detain and release ordinary citizens. So you bring, the Nazis would come in, show up one night and pull you out of your living room and gather you up and off you'd go. And sometimes you would disappear forever. This is certainly what Pinochet did in Chile. And this is certainly what Eva and Juan Perón did in Argentina. And it's to instill fear effectively, because when we are in a state of fear, it is very easy to control us. Now, the step seven would be to target key individuals. Step eight would be to restrict the press. Now, you know, I have an adage which I've shared on occasion, but I would reiterate it again today. We as conscious individuals who can see what's going on have the obligation to seek and to speak the truth. Step nine is to recast criticism as espionage and dissent as treason. Now, one of the things that comes out in the retrospective evaluation of Nazi Germany is the preponderance of the people in Nazi Germany who were not targeted, who were Aryan, who were considered safe. There was an act of complicitness. There was an act of watching out the window and going, ooh, what are they doing? I'll just hide in here for fear that they too would be incarcerated for whatever. And certainly, had you been helpful to the Jews, had you been helpful to those who were being persecuted, and you were viewed as help to the persecuted, help to the ordinary citizens, if you will, or the dissenters or those who were committing treason, you were incarcerated or taken away as well. So this is the instigation or the instilling of fear in society. You need to be terribly afraid of these bad guys, and they will protect you from the bad guys. And step number 10 is to act absolutely subvert the rule of law, and that I've spoken of many times. So again, I want to get back to the issue at hand, and the issue at hand is I want to respond to catastrophizing. I want to suggest that my objective is to point stuff out rather than to further create fear. And I want to point stuff out in a way that allows us and gives us a map, if you will, on how best to act as things come through. Now I'm going to set the tone yet again, and I'm going to speak about current events for a moment before we start diving into what to do in terms of preparation. Okay, so now I want to chat a little about what has been referred to in several times throughout the the past several years as the normalcy bias. Now, the normalcy bias is wanting to, or actually refusing to, see that things are changing. Now, the normalcy bias, if we go and play in Wikipedia, here's what Wikipedia says. It refers to a mental state people enter into when facing a disaster. Now, again, I apologize to my great friend for becoming a catastrophizer, but I want to chat about the normalcy bias. It causes people to underestimate both the possibility of a disaster occurring and its possible effects. Now, this may result in situations where people fail to adequately prepare for a disaster, and on a larger scale, the failure of governments to include the populace in its disaster preparations. Now, this brings me back to a conversation that we had with a physics teacher in high school. His name was Phil McGuire, and he was lovely. He was brilliant. He was eclectic. He was in my memory, one of my most enjoyable instructors. And he worked in the Army. He had a stint in the Army for a year or two or three or four, however many years. And then he went and got his master's in physics, and he was a teacher in the school system here in Calgary. Now, he would have all kinds of stories, but the most shocking story in his experience in the Army, in the military, and this is the Canadian Army too, by the way, not the U.S. Army, but his most shocking story about his time in the Army, which was around the time of the Cold War, no doubt, was this. In times of great calamity and great distress and in times of war, it wasn't the Army's position or place or objective to save people. It was the military's objective to remain whole in order to see themselves through the conflict. So, putting it in context, there was a definitive fear that the communists were going to come over here and run and ransack North America, which was not illegitimate at the time. There was great possibility of that and great potential of that. However, the issue at hand that he told us was the Army did not care about the population. They only cared about perpetuating their survival so they could fight another day. And that was drilled into them. So they were less concerned about the civilian population. They were not concerned at all about the civilian population. They were only concerned about their own survival, which at the time made me gasp with terror, really. So now, we get back to the normalcy bias. Now, the assumption that is made in the case of the normalcy bias is that since a disaster never has occurred, then it never will occur. It can result in the inability of people to cope with a disaster once it occurs, and people with a normalcy bias have difficulties reacting to something they have not experienced before. People always tend to interpret warnings in the most optimistic way possible, seizing on any ambiguities to infer a less serious situation. And then it goes on to say that the opposite of normalcy bias would be an overreaction or worst case thinking in which small deviations from normality are dealt with as if a change in status quo signals an impending catastrophe. So it is an interesting concept that the normalcy bias is being propagated by mainstream media, in that everything's okay and the governments are in control and the economy is coming back, because every now and again they do show up and they say the economy is strengthening, the government has a firm control and grasp on things. And to this I would again yell bullshit, because I think the methodology in which they are choosing to deal with the economy, the only way that they have to deal with the economy is to inflate their way out of it, to devalue the currency out of it, and to print money to get out of it. And what happens is the effect of printing money on the front end is large, and in the middle is very small, and in the end, it's the antithesis of small. It actually destroys things. And this is something that I've constantly undertaken to point out, that the government, I mean, and we talked about the dissolution of a democracy. The governments that be are constantly telling you that they will take care of yourselves. Now, again in response to the conversation that I had some short time ago, let us not catastrophize, let's just see things as they are. Why is it, and what is it that the governments are doing in such a fashion that would lend them to do this? And how is it that you can act or respond or prepare so that you can take preventative? So the preparative, the preparation is acknowledging and recognizing that the possibility of disaster is there. It is a possibility. Turning a blind eye or hiding your head in the sand is something that oftentimes leads to even more calamity. And there, the snowball is starting to gain momentum. Okay, it is starting to gain momentum. And what happens in terms of this? Well, let's chat a little about stock market calamities and collapses. We had one in 2008, and we've had dozens and dozens and dozens before, and certainly that is a topic for another program. But today we're going to talk just a little about what's going on right now. Okay, so the other issue that presents itself in terms of preparing and in terms of arming yourself, I'm not sure if the energy behind the word arming is appropriate, but let us use it anyways. And there are things in my misspent youth, I've done many things in the financial industry, but I look up to and have great respect for an enormous other amount of people. So this isn't a function of taking my word for it. It's a function of recognizing that things are happening right now, and other people in the markets are saying these very same things. Okay, so right now, 83% of the new stock offerings that have happened over the last 3 months are money-losing companies. Now, color me curious. When a company loses money in the simplest manner, it shouldn't have a value. It should have a negative value. It shouldn't have a positive value. It should have, in the simplest form. Now, there are all kinds of cases where we can play with, but if you're buying something that loses money every year, that tells me that it's a liability, not an asset. So that 83% of these money-losing companies, of the new stock offerings, is almost equal to the all-time record for that madness of 84% in the year 2000, which was during the dot-com bubble, the internet or the stock bubble, tech stock bubble. Now, there's a guy out there named David Einhorn, who's probably one of the five most successful hedge fund managers ever, and he's saying basically the same thing. So again, it's don't just listen to me. Go and do your research, which he did in a report, and it's been issued on the internet, David Einhorn. And he says he's selling short, which is sort of betting on the price to go down, and that means that he's going to make money as the prices of these stock fall. So his, and I'm quoting now from this report, our criteria for selecting stocks for the bubble basket is that we estimate there to be at least a 90% downside for each stock. Okay, so what he's saying is he thinks there's a good chance that the prices of these stocks will decline by 90% or more. Think that can't happen? Okay, so let's go back to the dot-com bubble, and here it is again. Okay, so there's a huge gap between the bubble price and the point where disciplined growth investors, let alone value investors, become interested buyers. When the last internet bubble popped, Cisco, which was the best of the best bubble stocks, fell 89%. Amazon fell 93%. And the lower quality stocks fell even more. An interesting fact, my daughter at the time in 2000 was working for a woman as a private chef. And I, for the life of me, I can't remember what the name of the stock was, but it was this company was taken to court because all she wanted to do was hire women, which was an interesting contrast to maleism, sexism. And her stock fell from $100 to $1 at the time. So Amazon in the last few days has fallen 6%. Okay, so get a load, right? David Einhorn, and the article is called "We Are Witnessing Our Second Tech Bubble in 15 Years." So, is that a perspective that's not mine? Yes. Is it a perspective that I share? Yes. And does it talk about perhaps getting out of the tech stocks? Well, maybe. In 2002, after the tech stocks crashed, Scott McNeely, who's the guy at Sun Microsystems, he's one of the founders and the CEO. He did a quite an infamous interview in Business Week. Now, Sun at the time was one of the many tech stock darlings, and that they made and sold. He's also a wonderful hockey player, or a big hockey player. He played hockey every day. They made and sold high power workstations, and they dealt with the scientific community. Wall Street, oil and gas engineers, all of them. And at its peak, the market valued his company at 10 times company sales. Now, putting that in perspective is a bit shocking. If you earn $100,000 a year as your income, that's like somebody saying to you, that's with no expenses, you are worth $1 million. However, you might be desperately in debt and consequently not worth any more than $1 million, barely worth $1,000 a month because your expenses go to living expenses. So at its peak, Sun was trading at about 10 times its sales. That's not profits again, right? So here was a quote from McNeely describing how absurd it was for the market to value his company at 10 times sales. But 2 years ago, we were selling at 10 times revenues when we were at $64. At 10 times revenues, to give you a 10-year payback, I have to pay you 100% of revenues for 10 straight years in dividends. That assumes I have zero cost of goods sold, which is very hard for a computer company. That assumes zero expenses, which is really hard with 39,000 employees. That assumes I pay no taxes, which is very hard. And that assumes you pay no taxes on your dividends, which is kind of illegal. And that assumes with zero R&D for the next 10 years, I can maintain the current revenue run rate. Now, having done that, would any of you like to buy my stock at $64? Do you realize how ridiculous those basic assumptions are? Now, to some minds, that would be tantamount to sacrilege that a CEO would come out and say his stock is overvalued. Okay. And consequently, his lawyers would have said, do not say that because it would be breach of fiduciary duty. However, in mid-March of this year, about a month ago, there were 40 companies valued at 10 times sales or higher. Goldman Sachs has it at a link. You just have to go look it up. America's most overvalued companies. On average, these 40 are valued at 15 times sales. Now to get back to David Einhorn's quote, after all, twice a silly price is not twice as silly, it's just silly. Now, it's very obvious that, as some would say, the sheep or the sheeple are getting set for another shearing just as they were in 2000 and again in 2007. When exactly this happens, I don't know. Timing is one of those things that many, many brilliant market players profess not to be very good. They just seen the signs and they take action prior to stuff happening. Okay. Can the stock market go higher? Yeah, absolutely. It depends on how much money the Fed prints and how long traders believe in the effectiveness of that printing and how big the many world wars or the wars in the world get. But I can't tell you for sure. I don't know. I do know that the action to take at this time in overvaluation, perhaps, if you are exposed to the tech stocks, might be to sell them. So I have nothing to do with stocks, and I don't want my savings anywhere near the stock account or the brokerage account. So I don't have to guess when the next shearing will happen. So there's a guy named Jeremy Grantham, who has a multi-decade real-time track record of predicting future returns from stock. And his firm publishes another newsletter, and Grantham's comments are followed on websites that we follow, on Zero Hedge and King World News. And here's some recent quotes and comments, right? Jeremy Grantham's comment, the S&P is approximately 75% overvalued. Its fair value is 1,100. Well, if it's 75% overvalued, it's valued closer to 2,000, right? We do think the market is going to go higher because the Fed hasn't ended its game and it won't stop playing until we are in an old-fashioned bubble territory and it bursts, which usually happens at 2 standard deviations from the market's mean, mathematical terms. That would take us to 2350 on the S&P 500, or roughly 25% from where we are now. Question to Grantham, are you putting your clients' money into the market? No. You ask me where the market is headed from here, but to invest our clients' money on the basis of speculation being driven by the Fed's misguided policies doesn't seem like the best thing to do with our clients' money. We invest our clients' money based on our 7-year prediction, and over the next 7 years, we think that the market will have negative returns. The next bust will be unlike any other, because the Fed and other central banks around the world have taken on all this leverage that was out there and put into their balance sheets. We have never had this before. Assets are overpriced generally. They will be cheap again. That's how we will play for this. Now, Grantham is a pretty bright guy and one of the few Wall Street people who is honest about various crises brewing in the world, and certainly one of the very few to quote Bob Marley. He wrote a report on the topic from the point of views of the numbers man, which he is. And welcome to dystopia, entering a long-term and politically dangerous food crisis. Has anybody noticed how the price of food is going up? We are this is Einhorn again. We are 5 years into a severe global food crisis that is very unlikely to go away. It will threaten poor countries with increased malnutrition and starvation and even collapse. Resource squabbles and waves of food-induced migration will threaten global stability and global growth. This threat is badly underestimated by almost everybody and all institutions, with the possible exception of some military establishments. Need I say more in that regard? Okay. So yes, here we are catastrophizing again. Here we are pointing out downside. Here we are pointing out what bright people are saying about what's going on. However, with nobody to listen, you become compromised by your lack of awareness. And your lack of awareness can work against you. Now, I want to return to the normalcy bias, which Einhorn and the various other people that I've just been reading to you have suggested it's time to wake up. But I also want to talk about a guy named Nassim Taleb. Now, Nassim Taleb wrote a book a while ago in 01. And he wrote a book in 01 called Fooled by Randomness. And he also wrote another book in 07 called The Black Swan. And he talked about, and he coined the phrase, he didn't coin it, but he reintroduced it to the jargon of our contemporary society. And he talks about the Black Swan events and how they relate to the financial markets. Now, Taleb also regards almost all major scientific discoveries, historical events, and artistic accomplishments as black swans. And the black swans are undirected and unpredicted. So he gives the rise of the internet, certainly the personal computer, World War I, dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the September 2, 2001 attacks as examples of black swan events. So this is not a new term or a new methodology, but what he goes on to say is that black swan events is an event with the following three attributes. First of all, it is an outlier, as it lies outside the realm of regular expectations, because nothing in the past can convincingly point to its possibility. However, I am a firm believer of what you don't know about the past, you are destined to relive. And that's part of remembering the past and using its lessons as signposts to guide you on the way. And second, the second point that he points out is that it has an extreme impact. And third, in spite of its outlier status, human nature makes us concoct, and he points out how brilliantly we concoct explanation for its occurrence after the fact, making it explainable and predictable. Now, the vile thing about all this is that we have an intellect, we have a mental body, a lower mental body in society today that is far more vested in being right than it is in being able to see things as they are. So what it does is it reformats, reformulates, recounts according to it being right, which is a pretty dangerous place to be. Now, the black swan events, and Taleb's whole position was that you, and we'll talk portfolio jargon for a moment, but you take your money, whatever it is, and you keep it very safe. You put it in things that are very safe, and then you invest a very small portion of your money on what could be termed lottery tickets of black swan events. And so consequently, he was very successful in doing this. And these are buying calls or puts in the event of something happening, and you buy them so far out of the money that they're very, very inexpensive. So, and the results and the rewards from doing this are enormous. So this would be akin, or not unlike, the institutions creating a derivative market to benefit from various things happening, and then the institutions themselves making those things happen so the derivatives that they've created have value, gaming the system. However, if you know the system is gamed, if you understand that calamities and collapses do happen, then you can bet on those calamities happening with very little amount of money that will have an enormous impact on your financial well-being. Now, as I've said before, in an esoteric point, we have what is coming right now is the end of one 26,000-year period and the beginning of another 26,000-year period. And this is called the end of the Kali Yuga, is the Hindus, or the day of Brahma would talk, and the beginning of the Golden Age. And the beginning of the Golden Age does not happen on a Thursday at 5 o'clock. It happens over time. And it happens in this instance. It's happened over the last 100 or so years, and it will continue to happen for the next 100 or so years. And its peak right now was December 21, 2012, in terms of that's the apotheosis. That's the peak of when the change experienced, and now we're sliding into this new age, the coming of the age of Aquarius. So as we fall into this new age, and some fall, some direct themselves, some organize themselves well so they do not have their wealth destroyed or wealth confiscated by the principles of how the governments rule the financial circuit, financial industry. We look at this with eyes open. So now I want to spend a bit of time now chatting about what to do. I'm not going to fill us anymore with the context of fear, because fear serves no one, absolutely no one, save those who peddle in it, because the ones who peddle in it want to direct you according to their agenda, which is one of the 10 things that close an open society, create a threat. So I want to chat a little about preparatory work, what to do. You say all these things, Jeff. You tell us all these calamities. You crap all over the system. You tell the system is broken and it's hurt and it's compromised by greed and it's falling apart. But what do you tell? I mean, what's the solution? What's the answer? What's the next step? Well, the next step is to get out of the system and reduce your exposure to a system that could potentially destroy your wealth. Now, we talk about buying gold and silver. And we have certainly seen for tens of thousands of years, if not more, gold and silver have become the default aspect of currency. And we certainly spoke on what gold was, as was given us by Saint Germain last week. We talked about how important gold was. He also suggested that gold's import as a currency for mankind was long-lasting, but it was also not nearly as consequential as the vibratory contributions that gold brings. So how is it that you act? Okay, so getting out of the system. It is probably prudent that you, well, let me rephrase this. In keeping with the law of free will, it is not my place to tell you what to do. It is my place to turn the lights on so you can make those decisions on yourself, and not believing in what I'm speaking of, but knowing what you know through your own research, by your own volition, by your own hand, and by the expression of your own willpower. So I will speak of what other people have done, given their grasp and knowledge of what I speak of on occasion. What other people have done is this. They have extricated themselves from exposure to the financial stock markets and the financial markets. They recognize, and I have friends who had money in institutions, certainly in institutions in Cyprus, which I've said before, where they had their money confiscated. So I would suggest if you have money in the bank, keep enough money in the bank so that you can use the system for the moment, but do not be surprised by taking money out of the system that its usefulness, should a bank go down, that you have cash on hand. People actually do still accept cash, although in the Canadian market, very few people use cash, and they're using electronic means. Now, what happened a little while ago, a couple of years ago, is Barclays Bank in London, England, because I had students in my class who had Barclays debit cards, they just announced, sorry, your debit cards don't work anymore. Oh, okay, well, when is that going to be fixed, they said. Well, we're not sure. We had a computer glitch. Okay, so nobody could use their debit cards. And consequently, the bank, in terms of servicing its money-paying customers and the people that they had that had given the bank their money in order to organize things, the bank not only was no longer servicing them, was using their money and hiding it away, whatever they were doing. So color me curious, and this is the, again, this is a maybe a skewed perspective, but I might suggest that the bank at the time said, well, let's run a quick test. Let's run a quick test and see how much crap we get into by shutting the system down for a few days to see if we can manipulate our holders, our clientele, if we can hold them captive for a few days by not letting their cards work. Let's do a test case, see how, what happens. Always with the promise that it'll get better. Always with the promise that we're working on fixing it. Always with representing that the interesting irony in the banking system is that the bank does not have your money. It's one of the fallacies. If everybody went to the bank and said, I want my savings out of the banks would go bust. It's part of the way that the banking system was set up for the bankers, not necessarily for the depositors. We trust that in the new shift that will change. However, if you have cash on hand and the bank says your money is frozen for a moment, even if it's 4 days, maybe it could be longer, you can still function. Get out of the system. Do you have retirement savings? Well, some would suggest, and some have done, they've said, I'm going to cash in my RRSPs. I'm going to get out of my RRSPs because I think and believe and respectfully acknowledge that what I now know is that the stock markets are not holders of true value. The stock market is broken. There is such, in my opinion, but certainly in others, there is such high systemic risk right now going on in the marketplace that the stock market, in terms of a potential next collapse, is vulnerable to having the system itself break. Not just stock prices fall, but the system itself break. There are $250 billion worth of derivatives out there flowing back and forth and having been created. If all of those came into cash in, it's that value or that destruction of value is worth more than the entire global's GDP. Okay. So now getting out of the system. Getting out of the system talks about having cash. Getting out of the system talks about owning real assets. Getting out of the system talks about having access to food stores, having access to some stuff put away in your basement so you can survive for a day or a week or a month. There's a guy who spent an enormous amount of time and has a wonderful website called peakprosperity.com, and his name is Chris Martinson. Now, this guy's no lightweight, and he's got his MBA and his PhD, and he has an enormously comprehensive site, and he's got a little crash course called The Crash Course on his site. So I would suggest that forewarning allows you to forearm. I would also suggest that owning gold and silver and those commodities is probably not a bad idea. I would also propose and suggest that being aware of the normalcy bias, being conversant in the fact that the powers that be do not have your interests at heart, they will tell you such. But when push comes to shove, all of the stuff that I've spoken of for a long time would suggest that the government's agenda is contrary to the interests of its constituents. So getting out of the system talks about being self-reliant and independent of the system. just as we have early storm warnings, and Mexico, in fact, has an early earthquake warning system, which is worth the tens of millions of dollars. The Americans are not prepared to spend that money because they don't have it. Yet they're prepared to spend money on military actions around the world, which I think is a bit laughable. However, we are also, and have chatted a little about the what's happening on the planet, and how in this last little bit of time we're seeing the statistical observation that we're having almost one earthquake a day of a magnitude 6 or greater. So do you think the Earth is not connected to this? I beg to differ. Do you think that there are those around here that suggest that they know what's going on, but they don't want people to panic? Yeah. Panic doesn't serve anybody. As I said, fear does not serve anybody. Awareness, self-reliance. You have the obligation to you and your family and your community to seek out and speak the truth. This stuff has happened before. This stuff will continue to happen. And part of what to do is to make preparation for it to happen. What would it hurt you to go to the grocery store, to go to a Costco and buy some foodstuff that is safe and will keep for a while? Why would that hurt you? It's as if it is buying insurance. And from one of a very successful investor of years ago, he used to buy gold stock or gold options every month. He just used to spend a bit of money every month on buying gold options. My suggestion is, being in the paper market in anything right now is a bit risky. It's not something I am doing. However, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to tell you that I choose to turn the lights on so you can make your own decisions on your own volition by your own hand. Getting out of the system, investigating Chris Martinson's peakprosperity.com. There's a little crash course in there that might be useful to you. Mindfulness, discrimination. The current situation is not going to go back to normal. You now know what the normalcy bias is. You now know what preparatory work might look like. And you now know, and we have hopefully addressed, the answer to bitching and moaning and complaining about the system. Because bitching and moaning and complaining about it isn't the answer. Turning the lights on about it and making preparation for its decline or collapse is incredibly important to our collective well-being. A bit of a departure from the ancient wisdom and the ancient teachings, but certainly an invitation to recognize, viewing things with eyes unclouded by either the normalcy bias or by the predisposition to see what you want to see. Eyes unclouded by longing. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will bid you adieu. Thank you very much for allowing us to be of service. Thank you very much for our capacity to create an environment where you can retool for the next and our coming of age. Greatly appreciate your time. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be of service. And I look forward to speaking with you next week.